All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show today, and I'm going to run it out real quick because I want to get right into it. All right, so on the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Bob Perry, investigative journalist and editor of ConsortiumNews.com. We're going to be talking about a new attempt by reactionary right-wing forces to take over many of the major newspapers in the country, so stay tuned for that. In the middle of the program, we're going to be talking with Wayne Kramer. That's right, Wayne Kramer, musician formerly of MC5 and co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors. We're going to be speaking up with Wayne about the other death penalty, life without parole, so you don't want to miss that one either. And opening the show up, I'm extremely pleased to welcome back to the show after a long hiatus, Larry Everest. Larry is a journalist with Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're going to be talking with Larry about Syria. What the hell's going on in Syria? What's the U.S. doing there? What's all the, you know, how do we look at that? How do we understand that? And what do we need to do about it? Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Yeah, you too, man. It's been a while. So it's,
yeah.
I'll cut the banner.
Well, my phone hasn't been ringing, Michael, you know, so.
It's funny. I call and all I get is like beep, 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 beep. Anyway, all right, let's cut the banner and jump right into it. Syria on everybody's mind. It seems to be more and more so these days. There's all kinds of things that are coming up. There's a hearkening back to, you know, some people are saying a hearkening back to the days before the Iraq War in the early 2000s, in 2003 and whatnot, 2002. There's a whole scene that's developing there that is really taking things much higher, much hotter than they have been. Let's jump into this. I want people to get an understanding. First of all, what can you tell us about an update on it, and a little bit of the background around this?
Well, first of all, the U.S. has been escalating its intervention, beginning months ago, stepping up CIA support for Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and other efforts to arm the Syrian opposition. And then recently, we just got the word that Obama's considering direct U.S. military support for the so-called rebels, which are largely, not exclusively, it's a complicated mix of forces, but the dominant forces are pro-U.S. reactionaries and Islamist reactionaries, neither of which promises anything good for the Syrian people. And the news of the last few days, of course, has been Obama's claim that the U.S. now has proof that chemical weapons have been used inside of Syria. And it's interesting to look at exactly how he said it. He posed as being someone much more reasonable as Bush. He runs out that they have proof, but then he says, you know, that they need more evidence. We don't have the chain of custody that establishes exactly what happened and all this. So, you know, the impression is that he's doing something different than Bush. No, he's being more clever and sophisticated about it. But the fact is that the claim that the U.S. has evidence that chemical weapons have been used is a lie. Tracy Shelton, the reporter for Global Post, and others was on the scene in Aleppo. She documented very carefully that what had happened might have been a tear gas attack, but was not consistent with sarin gas, which is what's being claimed. I mean, let's not forget that a week ago, Chuck Hagel, the defense secretary, just dismissed all of the claims which were first raised by Israel. And, of course, here, who else has been using tear gas? Bahrain, Egypt, all sorts of U.S. allies against people. So what's going on here is not that the U.S. has learned their quote-unquote lesson, never lie again, never have so-called bad intelligence. No, the lesson they learned was to lie more cleverly, and that's what they're attempting to do now. But like Iraq, these are lies driven by an agenda of imperialism and imperialist interests, not humanitarian concerns.
Well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, journalist with Revolution Newspaper and author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking about Syria. Let me ask you this, and I just want to do one more thing around the sarin stuff that's going on. You know, it struck me, it's very heavy because, Even the, you know, the idea, I read one place where some U.S. officials were saying, well, the reason we can't really find evidence of sarin is because, or other chemical weapons, is because they're now being moved around in large trucks around the country. You know, and I kept thinking, okay, I remember the Winnebagoes of death that Colin Powell had talked about in Iraq, you know. And there's a whole thing going on here, though, of when people keep talking about, you know, the U.S., the media, the U.S. officials, all the stuff, they talk about this idea that suddenly the Syrian regime appears as this is the boogeyman in the area. This is the thing that's going to wreck everything because these are the only people that are, you know, taking up this thing around chemical weapons, chemical warfare. There's quite a history there. When the U.S. talks about, you know, the history or talks about sarin and chemical weapons and the use of this, there's quite a bit of they're sort of drenched in hypocrisy as they talk, aren't they?
Absolutely. And let's be clear, even if Syria, which is a reactionary regime, I'm not a defender of the Syrian regime in any way, shape, or form, but even if Syria had used chemical weapons, U.S. intervention would not be justified. It would still be illegitimate because the U.S. is not intervening in Syria to eliminate the danger of chemical weapons around the world. Just as it's not threatening Iran now in order to eliminate nuclear weapons. The U.S. has its own stockpile of chemical weapons, which it's refused to have thoroughly inspected. It supports two other countries who've refused to sign the prohibition against chemical weapons, as Syria hasn't signed it, but neither has Israel and Egypt, U.S. allies. Where's the crisis atmosphere being whipped up around that sort of thing? Or not to mention the treatment of the masses of people in Gaza. I was even thinking before you called, where's the crisis atmosphere around factory conditions in Bangladesh, where dozens of U.S. multinationals are making their clothes? So I'm not saying the situation isn't very dire for the people of Syria. It is, but there's many situations around the world where people are suffering enormous horrors, and there's no sense of quote-unquote crisis. We have to do something right away. This is being whipped up by the U.S. to serve its own interests. And then, as you say, look at the track record of the United States. I read a piece by Robert Fisk that raised that possibly phosphorus weapons had been used and could have accounted for some of the burns. Well, the U.S. used massive white phosphorus bombings in Fallujah in Iraq. The U.S. supported and actually assisted Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war in getting chemical weapons and covertly supported their use against Iran that resulted in thousands and thousands of people being killed. I document this thoroughly in my book. And even after Saddam Hussein massacred thousands of Kurds at Halabja and other places in 1988, the U.S. didn't break relations with Saddam Hussein. In fact, they refused to do that, and they wanted to continue to strengthen relations with Hussein at that point. So again, U.S. intervention has nothing to do with protecting the world from chemical weapons or tyranny or anything else. It's aimed at strengthening the U.S. stranglehold on that entire region. And people have to stop and think, how did we get to the position we're in right now? It's mainly because of the actions that the United States has taken over the last 60-plus years.
All right, let me ask you this. Let's stop there for a second, and I'll jump right into that. But I want to let people know that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Larry Everest, and we're talking about Syria and what's going on there now, what people should do. You know, basically, how do we understand what's happening in Syria today? Now, Larry, you've been making this point that you're just getting into, is that everything the U.S. is doing in there, everything that's developed that the U.S. has to do with any part of Syria and what's happening there is, and their attitude towards it, is all pinned on and built around their interests, the pursuit of their imperial interests. Let's talk about that.
Well, first of all, people should know when it suited U.S. interests. For example, in the Desert Storm invasion of 1991, and then in the so-called War on Terror this last decade, it has used the Assad regime as an ally, including sending people there for torture. But at this point, my sense of what's driving the particular escalation is the U.S. is concerned, A, that the continuation of the civil war may not topple Assad, B, that it will strengthen jihadist or Islamist forces, and C, it could undermine U.S. allies in this region. And this is why it's being pushed to escalate things. Now, let's not forget that a key objective in overthrowing Assad is weakening the Islamic Republic of Iran, which the U.S. considers its main strategic obstacle in this region. I mean, the U.S., if you want to look at the aftermath of September 11th, the U.S. has been waging a war across, in certain ways, in different forms, but in certain ways across the whole Middle East, Central Asian region, in order to try to defeat its opponents, whether they be Islamic radicals or secular governments that aren't particularly in the U.S. pocket, and more deeply impose its imperialist control of this region and strengthen the state of Israel as a key pillar of that, as well as Saudi Arabia. So that's what's really driving this, not concerns about the people of Syria who are suffering enormously.
Now, Larry Everest, listen, one of the things that's going to come up, and it has already come up in many ways from a lot of different people, similar to what happened when Libya was going on and the whole campaign against the Gaddafi government in Libya. You know, the idea that somehow that this is a game changer, to borrow Obama's words, this is a game changer for the people who actually care about what's happening in the world, who are looking for ways to stand up against various forms of imperialist oppression. And a lot of people are saying, look, the problem in Syria, as it was in Libya, is you have people living under a butcher, and that really there's lots of calls coming out for the U.S. to intervene. Why isn't the U.S. intervening? Why won't they go in there and do something? Why won't they even do, you know, why won't they start to help the rebels? You know, and there's a whole thing that's being posed as the choice is either we get behind the U.S. imperialist backing, you know, backing their whatever intervention they choose to take in this in conjunction with their allies, or we stand behind this bloody, ruthless dictator as he slaughters more and more people. What's up with that?
Well, that's a really important question, Michael, and people get drawn into the framework that the imperialists create, which is the only two choices are back what they're doing, intervention, or allow people to die. But let's look, the worst thing in the world is the United States getting involved in this in any way, shape, or form. Look at Afghanistan. Look at Iraq. Look at Libya. All of them had repressive, reactionary regimes. The U.S. came in and took down all three of them. What was the result? Number one, untold devastation and destruction in Iraq. Perhaps 1 million dead, 4 million displaced from their homes, another 4 million wounded, and the imposition of a reactionary regime. You can see the same thing in Afghanistan, the same thing in Libya. The other thing, and this is an important insight Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has had, is that broadly across the region, we have a clash of two reactionary outmoded social forces. Imperialism on the one hand, which of course is the much more powerful and dangerous element of this, and on the other, Islamic fundamentalism, which represents the interests of outmoded reactionary strata in these oppressed countries. And both of these forces fuel each other. The more the U.S. attacks, the more it strengthens fundamentalism. And that if we side with either one of those forces, we're strengthening both. And just look at what has happened across that region as a result of the U.S. wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan and Libya. It's been a horror for the people, and it's been strengthened reactionary fundamentalism. And the same will happen in Syria. And I think the realistic choice that people need to get with is, number one, if people in this, we need to bring forward a different way. We need to fight to create another choice. So it isn't simply a choice between Islamic fundamentalism and imperialism, or imperialism and doing nothing and not caring. First of all, we should really be protesting and opposing any kind of U.S. intervention at all, and visibly manifest protests so people around the world know we do not support the criminal actions of the United States government. The second thing that I think is incredibly important, and again, I refer people to a statement Bob Avakian made about Egypt, millions have heroically stood up, the future remains to be written, which is at RevCom. And in this, he points out that what is really called for is a revolutionary communist leadership and pole as a viable and visionary alternative to either of these outmoded. So we need to fight and work to make that a reality, to spread the understanding of the work he's been doing in bringing forward this new synthesis of communism, because people in the Middle East and Central Asia, as well as other parts of the world, desperately, desperately need this. It's a way out of this, and they need to know about it.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, journalist with Revolution Newspaper and author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking about Syria.
Well, let me ask you one final question, Larry. Let's recap again. This point about anything that's happening that the U.S. does, and I think this is something, you know, that, again, people always couch this stuff in as the U.S. is not operating according to its interests in the region, or if it is operating according to its interests, they are humanitarian interests. Let's close out on recapping for people. When you made the point that everything the U.S. has done in relation to Syria and in relation to the entire region has been about their imperial interests. What are their interests there?
Well, just stop and think for a minute. Overall, their interest there is controlling this geopolitical crossroads of the world where 60% of the world's oil and energy resources lie. And as I document in my book, this has been a key to U.S. global power all over the world, because of the strategic role of oil, not for the just for the U.S. or even mainly for the U.S., but in the global economy. And it's also a very powerful geopolitical weapon against other rival powers, for example, Russia and China. So that's the big picture. But think about it. What does that entail directly? It entails backing and maintaining this extremely reactionary, repressive series of pro-U.S. states, starting with Israel, which is based on ethnic cleansing, continuing to commit crimes against humanity against the Palestinians, to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. Look, nobody is screaming emergency in Bahrain, where the Shia population is being ruthlessly suppressed. They're using tear gas, and if you want to call that a chemical weapon, that's being used. There's no screaming about that. So the U.S. is aiming to preserve the reactionary Gulf states and Saudi Arabia and Egypt as well, which has been a key pillar of U.S. interest. So when we're talking about defending what the U.S. imperialists try to maintain their control, this is based on extreme violence, torture, and repression, as well as exploitation of the people there. There's absolutely nothing good about it. And it is not the realistic choice in this situation to back U.S. intervention, because that's just about keeping this same world of horrors in place indefinitely.
All right, Larry, thank you very much. We'll have you back again soon. We'll follow up on this and other things that are developing in the region. So talk to you again soon, man.
Oh, Okay, man. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Wayne Kramer. Welcome back. And that's Talking About Freedom from Fontella Bass. And I couldn't think of a more appropriate song today because, you know, we've been talking a lot about prison and prisoners and what's happening in the prisons and to prisoners and what's being done by prisoners over the last few weeks. And Wayne Kramer, who's our guest on this section of the show, wrote to me recently and basically pointed out to me another aspect of things that are going on. And that is when you're talking about what's happening with the death penalty, you're talking about prisoners in solitary, you're talking about one of the most heinous ways that prisoners are being, you know, punished and tortured, actually, is includes the other death penalty, what the people are calling the other death penalty, and that is life without parole. Okay? And this is a, you know, when you look at what's going on around that, it's just really a heinous crime. It's actually it ranks right up there in the annals of torture and war crimes. I think it's just a really remarkable. And I have to thank Wayne for pointing this out to me because I hadn't paid enough attention to actually what was going on with that. But instead of me describing it, I'm going to welcome Wayne Kramer, musician, formerly MC5 and co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors, and now very active with the Other Death Penalty Project. Wayne, how are you?
I can't complain, Michael, yourself.
I'm pretty good, although I could complain. But we'll talk about that later.
Well,
yeah.
You sound good.
Oh, good. You too. Well, let's jump into this, man. You pulled my coattail on the Other Death Penalty Project. And why don't you tell people what that is and why you think it's so important?
Well, we have an Indiegogo campaign trying to raise enough money to publish a book called Too Cruel, Not Unusual Enough, written by and edited by LWOP prisoners in America's prisons. LWOP is a life without the possibility of parole. And I think the book is a powerful statement and an educational tool entertaining, if that's all you're looking for, a look into the effects of what I think is our most obscene attempt at the administration of justice. So if people want to go to the Indiegogo site of the Other Death Penalty, they could make a contribution. So we can get this book printed up and get it in circulation. You know, books can be very powerful tools in carrying information and carrying a message out to the world about what's going on. You know, it's not something that's talked about much. It's like to quote the Professor Robert Johnson at the American University, that America's been searching for a humane method of execution. You know, we've gone from hangings to firing squads to electric chairs to gas chambers and the current method of choice, lethal injection. But life without parole is a death sentence. That person is sentenced to die in prison, and you know, the book really illuminates the voices of those people that are actually, you know, serving those sentences. And you know, there's times in life when life itself is harder to bear than death, and life without the possibility of parole, a life with no hope, might be one of those times.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Wayne Kramer, musician, co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors, and working a person who's helping out with working with the other death penalty project around life without parole. Yeah, you know, Ken Hartman, one of the people who actually began this movement around the other death penalty project, very, very heavy. You know, to read some of the things that he's written and some of the things that he said, to listen to him speak, it's very moving what he's talking about. And in particular, you actually picked up on this as well. You said that, look, that life without the possibility of parole is barbaric beyond the definition of the word. Let's give people a sense of that, because, you know, I think it's, you know, when you think about that, we all wake up, no matter how bad things are, you generally think, okay, you wake up and, you know, something could change, something could happen. You have something to look forward to. When you're doing life without parole, there's just a void there.
Well, it's worse than that, because when you accept an LWOP sentence, and most people that accept these sentences, these are plea bargains, they think they're getting a better deal. But what you do is you give up all your constitutional rights to appeal. So once you accept the LWOP plea bargain, you have no appeal. You have no option to go back to court. The death sentence carries all kinds of legal protections. This sentence carries nothing. And as a result, people with this sentence are relegated to yards in the system where there are no programs. There's no education programs. There's no therapy programs. And the attitude is, well, why should we rehabilitate you? You're never going out anyway, which is, you know, unbelievably callous. In California alone, there's 4,000 people serving this sentence. You can't tell me out of 4,000 people, not one of them is capable of saving, of rehabilitating, of redemption. You know, our justice system is to be tempered by mercy, and this is a merciless sentence, as is the death penalty. It is the death penalty, and it kind of lulls the anti-death penalty people into thinking, well, this is a viable alternative. It's not an alternative. It's the same thing, but worse.
Once again, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Wayne Kramer, musician, formerly of the MC5 and co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors. And we're talking about the other death penalty, life without the possibility of parole. Now that you bring up this point about a lot of the death penalty opponents, actually, who you have to give them a lot of credit for constantly standing up against the death penalty and the imposition of a very barbaric penalty for whatever people do. But I think the point that you're making is actually very important. And I know this is one of the things that you're trying to do with this book, you know, to get it onto to these organizations as well. Because last year in the elections, there was that, what was it, Prop 34, that where people were getting behind that and saying, well, okay, end the death penalty and instead put people on life without parole, as if that was some sort of viable alternative, as you're saying. And it's not. It actually is. Even in a lot of ways, it's worse. I mean, I saw one person, I don't know whether it was Ken or somebody else, who said, look, perhaps it's time, you know, I start thinking that maybe that 15 to 20 minutes where you would be executed is better than the lifetime of dying every day.
Well, you know, this sentence is a relatively new invention in the business of corrections. It's only emerged in the last 30 years. No country in the you know, industrialized Western country, I mean, most of them don't even have the death penalty, let alone life without the possibility of parole. And in fact, most third world countries don't have the death penalty or life without the possibility of parole. You know, for a country, for America, who takes great pride in crowing about American exceptionalism, in terms of how we administer justice, what we are is exceptionally ignorant and exceptionally cruel. You know, there's 40,000 people serving this sentence across the country, and I just can't believe that out of 40,000 people, none of them are redeemable. None of them would do the work necessary to change and find a way to be productive member of society. Certainly, some folks need to stay confined that are so damaged that, you know, they can only relate to other humans violently. I believe in the rule of law, and I'm an ex-offender myself. But I think that, you know, when you rob all hope from someone, what is there to live for? Breathing in and out another day of humiliation and degradation at the hands of, prison guards who find you less than human.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Wayne Kramer, musician, co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors, and working a person who's helping out with working with the other death penalty project around life without parole, prisoners sentenced to, people sentenced to what actually amounts to another death penalty, exactly as it's said.
It is the death penalty.
Exactly.
And I'll tell you, Michael, in California so far, not one person has ever been released from this sentence.
Mm-hmm.
There is no appeal. There is no clemency. There is no way out.
Now, some of the horror in this too, Wayne. Part of this is actually, for a long time, this has actually been applied to juveniles as well, right?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. We're for a country that prides itself on its moral high ground. We're not all. We don't have much to crow about, really.
Yeah, the moral high.
You know, Indiegogo, the other death penalty. I just suggest people go there. There's a couple of short films on there. There's some information, and the book is a tremendous read. I mean, the men and women that have written this thing, and Ken edited it, and wrote a chapter himself. Ken's really an articulate spokesman and a great example of a guy who made a terrible mistake when he was 19 years old, 19-year-old punk rocker in Orange County, who beat a guy up in a fight, and the guy died. You know, he didn't mean to kill the guy, but the guy died. It was a horrific thing to have happen. And Ken didn't know his rights, had a public defender. They said, we want to give you the death penalty, but we're going to cut you a break and give you this LWOP sentence. What did he know? Sure, okay, great, sounds good. And now he's been down 33 years. He's educated himself. He has a wife and a daughter. He's a leader in prison reform from the inside. And, if anyone has ever deserved another shot and who has paid a terrible price, I mean, he's lived his entire adult life and, you know, proven beyond any reasonable measure that he's worthy of another shot.
Once again, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Wayne Kramer, musician, formerly of the MC5 and co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors. And we're talking about the other death penalty, life without the possibility of parole. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of the things that I wanted to talk...
He's not the only one.
Right. Well, that's what one of the things I wanted to get into with you is, you know, part of this is there's a relationship between this and the struggle against this life without parole sentence, this other death penalty, and the idea, the whole thing that's been going on in the California prisons overall over the last couple of years, the prisoner hunger strikes, the assertion by a lot of the prisoners that, damn it, we are human and we demand to be treated as such. You know, and you've made a point, I've heard and read in places, you've made a point where you really take on this idea that somehow this is, you know, look, this is actually revenge punishment. There's no, as you were saying earlier, there's no point about in here about any kind of rehabilitation or restoration to society. It's just push them in, bury them, let them, you know, forget about it. That's it. And you know, you dehumanize them. And you've spoken pretty eloquently about the dehumanization involved in this, as have the prisoners overall in California and those in the hunger strike who stood up and said, look, our only way to live right now is to resist, and that's what gives us hope. And we have been completely dehumanized, and they echoed what the Attica brothers said way back in 71, that mm-hmm. we're human beings and we demand to be treated as such. That's our basic demand. Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, you're sentenced to prison as punishment, not for punishment. You know, the punishment is serving time in confinement. You're not sent to prison to be punished. And American politicians throughout the last 30 years have found a gold mine in tough on crime policy. You know, nobody ever lost an election by saying I'm tough on crime. And what they've done is it's kind of an extension of the Southern strategy.
they've used fear of crime as leverage in a political campaign. And it's a straw dog. Crime has remained the same over all these last 50 years, and in fact, violent crime has gone down through better policing. Sending people to prison doesn't actually prevent crime, but what it did do is it managed to create a gigantic prison industrial complex and get a lot of politicians elected, Democrats and Republicans, based on this lock them up and throw away the key idea. I mean, when I was in prison, I caught the tail end of the era of rehabilitation, where the point of the prison facility was to figure out what the hell your problem is and help you fix it. I saw that end. And as an official policy, the policy changed to punitive incapacitation. What that gets us is people that are now locked up for decades sometimes in a world of violence, racism, defeat, bitterness, and then who are released back on the world with no job training, no therapy, no nothing to help them look inward and figure out where they went wrong, no support when they come out, and they're bitter, angry, resentful, and they've been in crime school for the last 10 years. And so in the end, the get tough crime on crime policies have left us less safe than we were when we started. So this has been a complete perfect storm of a disaster of a social policy.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Wayne Kramer, musician, co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors, and working a person who's helping out with working with the other death penalty project around Life Without Parole. Let me ask you this, Wayne, as sort of the last question I'll ask you, which is, you know, I understand what you're saying in terms of what practically what's happened, but actually, isn't there, and I think you would agree with this, isn't there, though, this overriding question of the fundamental need to recognize the humanity in each and every person, and the fact that you know, without doing that, when you don't allow for that, when you deny the humanity in each person, that's the biggest question. You're denying the humanity in the people that end up in prison, the people that get locked up, no matter what they did. I mean, this thing, I read Ken's, you know, account of what he did, and one of the things that's true, when you look at him, he fought to reclaim his humanity, but the prison system constantly denies that. And that's what really gets me, is the dehumanization here.
Yeah, it's you know, prisons are today designed to inculcate in you a sense of worthlessness. I mean, that's why the work we do in Jail Guitar Doors, to use arts in corrections as one of the most effective methods of putting one in touch with their own humanity. In fact, later today, I'm going to testify at a Senate hearing for the Joint Committee on the Arts. Senator Curran Price is holding downtown on called Undereducate and Over-Incarcerate, and me and Actors Gang founder Tim Robbins and Jack Bowers, a great musician who has run the Arts and Corrections Program in the CDCR for 22 years, and a whole host of others that have been working to reintroduce arts programs into the California Department of Prisons, are going to talk about the efficacy of it, that, you know, art, you know, music, dance, theater, writing is one of the few ways that you can, one of the few things that actually have the power to transform people and connect them with their humanity. Mm-hmm. And it's something that, you know, of course, you know, that segment of the population that is driven by retribution and revenge, they can't see it. You know, they can't get their head wrapped around it. So we're going to make an argument today that that there should be a slice of this huge corrections budget that goes to arts and corrections.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing, just on a closing note, I think one thing that we also have to keep remembering is that this whole era of mass incarceration has so much to do with aiming at the control and the suppression of particular sections of the population, the vast numbers of Black and Latino people that are in there, more than half of the prison population today, Black and Latino, the slow genocide that's being unleashed against Black people, this kind of thing that really people have to keep in mind whenever they're thinking about or talking about what's going on in the prisons.
Well, I agree. You know, half of the people in prison in America are nonviolent drug offenders. And people of color, black people and brown people, don't use any more drugs than white people. They don't deal any more drugs than white people. But who's in prison?
Exactly.
Black people and brown people.
Exactly.
So racism is alive and well in America. You know, these are mostly folks of limited economic means, you know, that, believe me, if there was 2.3 million white boys in prison, this would be over with.
Good.
Moms and dads and lawyers would be all over it.
We'll take that point up next time around, Wayne. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Sure.
I appreciate the chance to blab on the radio.
Sure. We'll have you back again soon, man. Take care.
I appreciate it. So
sure.
long, pal.
Bye now. All right, and just so people want to, if people want to know a way to get in touch with the Other Death Penalty Project, write to the Other Death Penalty Project, P.O. Box 1486, Lancaster, California, 93584, or email todp@live.com. That's todp@live.com. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Bob Perry from ConsortiumNews.com about his latest article, It's the Media, Stupid.
So many cover-ups, nothing's ever what it seems. That's scandal.
Scandal, scandal, scandal. Yow, yow, hey, hey.
Could bring the government to its knees.
Right up to them knees. Yow, them a bad, please, 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 yow, yow.
This is a warning.
That's right, a global warning, Masters of Deception by Ghetto Priest. Robert Perry is our next guest. Bob is an investigative journalist and editor of ConsortiumNews.com. And Bob is someone who, he's an investigative journalist, a reporter, and he broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 1980s. And something I guess we'll talk about as part of our conversation today, he also paid a price for that. It has a lot to do with what I read in his most recent article on the media on ConsortiumNews.com, and the title was, It's the Media, Stupid. And, of course, anytime somebody titles something like that, I'm immediately drawn to it. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You talk about, you start off your article by saying that, look, the Koch brothers are actually making an attempt to buy the LA Times and many other regional newspapers. And you make a point that this is an extremely significant move. Why?
Well, it's also a move that's been building for many, many years. Really coming out of the 1970s, when there was, at the time, the American left had a pretty vibrant media. This was called the underground press. There was Ramparts Magazine. There was Dispatch News, a wire service. So, and there were many radio stations that were presenting a more progressive point of view. That changed in the 70s, where many of those outlets were shut down or sold off. The left sort of changed its sort of focus away from the outreach that it was doing. Meanwhile, the right stepped in and understood the power of having this sort of media outreach to the American people, and they poured tons of money into it. Literally billions and billions of dollars went into building newspapers and magazines and print publishing houses, and of course radio and TV, and then later the internet. So you had this enormous pressure from the right to build its own media, and they also combined it with attack groups that were well funded to go after those journalists in the mainstream press that were still trying to do their jobs right, so they could be targeted and attacked and knocked down. And it all worked very effectively for the right. And over the years, we saw this dramatic change in the way the American news media functioned, where you had a very aggressive right-wing media and a fairly intimidated, willing to play ball with this kind of nonsense mainstream media. And that is the reality we face today. And now it's being moved even further along by the pressures of Rupert Murdoch to purchase some more of the major old newspapers that still have a great deal of influence in the country, and as well as the entrance of the Koch brothers, who are big supporters of sort of free market libertarian principles. And the idea is to sort of snatch up some of the Chicago Tribune Company newspapers and include some of the big names that are left, things like the Baltimore Sun, Chicago Tribune, L.A. Times, and others. So there'll be even more right-wing propaganda being pumped into our political process.
You know, you make a point in your article that it's both a question that, you know, you have this point about exactly what you're saying is there's an editorial position that when you own a paper, when you own a newspaper, you actually push an editorial position a lot of times. And, you know, that's why people, it's true, that's why these forces buy newspapers, to get their view, to get their view of the world out there and as dominant as possible in the world. You also made the point, though, that I thought epistemologically was very interesting to me, because you said that, look, a lot of times with the U.S. press, it wasn't so much a question of whether they were liberal or conservative, but whether they actually attempted to be accurate. And one of the things you see in the press outlets that are owned by these rich, reactionary, conservative, whatever, there's the concern for accuracy is very, very small.
Right, there's almost none. When you look at places like Fox News, for instance, there's almost an eagerness, a happiness almost, about just saying things that are outrageously crazy, but saying them often enough so that a big chunk of the population starts believing them. But one of the things that the right did very effectively back, I'd say, in the 80s when I was with the AP and Newsweek, was to demonize accurate information as liberal. So, for instance, even in the 70s, if you were to write about Richard Nixon's ties to Watergate, which were certainly accurate, actually didn't go nearly as far as the actual ties, that was put into question by calling it liberal. The same when people wrote about the death squad operations in Central America in the 1980s that Ronald Reagan was supporting, by calling that liberal. A lot of Americans suspected it must not be true. It's biased. When actually those were accurate, honest accounts. And you can even take this back to the civil rights days, when some of the press was doing a more honest job in reporting the crimes of segregation, the cruelty of segregation. But that was put into question by calling it biased and liberal. And so this has been a pattern that we've seen where the truth, or let's say accurate information in many of these cases, is demonized as liberal, whereas then much of the public sort of throws that in together with all the other political gibberish they're hearing, and the idea of what actually is empirically true is lost. And that's a very dangerous thing for a democracy.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Robert Perry, investigative journalist and editor of ConsortiumNews.com. And we're talking about the media and the history behind recent right-wing attempts to create an even more monopolized press. Now, In terms of examples, I wanted you to talk a little bit about, you had your own personal experience with this. You and then someone that was a close friend of yours, Gary Webb. Those were two examples, I think, really were some of the sharpest over the last 20 years to have emerged, 20, 30 years to have emerged. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, sure. When I was with the AP back in the mid-1980s, an AP colleague, Brian Barger, and I did the first story about how the Nicaraguan Contras had gotten involved pretty deeply in cocaine trafficking. It was one of the ways they were funding their operations. And that was being protected by the Reagan administration for political reasons, or maybe even geopolitical reasons. They didn't want their clients, the Contras, to be seen as drug traffickers, which they were. So there was an effort to demonize that line of inquiry. It was dismissed as kind of a conspiracy theory. No matter how much evidence we actually had and how solid it was always being called that. And many of the major news organizations, the New York Times, Washington Post, joined in that attack on us. And also against John Kerry, when Senator Kerry actually did a very courageous investigation, which confirmed what we had written and actually took it much further. And he was ridiculed. Newsweek at the time called him a Randy conspiracy buff. So you had this sort of phenomenon that was, and when I went to work at Newsweek, and there I really ran headlong into this deep-seated feeling among the senior executives that we weren't supposed to write those kinds of stories because they undermined credibility of the U.S. government. They weren't, quote, good for the country. There was that sort of attitude, which came out during my continuing work on the Iran-Contra scandal, where I was pretty much told, just stop it. I was even literally told by the bureau chief, Evan Thomas, not to read the Iran-Contra report when it came out from Congress, because you do want me working on it anymore, and no one else did. So there was that kind of pressure that if you fought against it and tried to do your job right, it got you in trouble with your top editors. And ultimately, I decided I'd leave Newsweek. They didn't want me anymore, and I left. But that was the kind of pressure we all were encountering, those of us who were still doing our jobs. Gary Webb comes along in 1996 at the San Jose Mercury News and revives the Contra drug story, showing what the effect was actually when those drugs got into the United States, i.e. the spreading of the crack epidemic. And he came under fierce attack, not as much even by the government at that point, because now we're in the 90s and a lot of the Reagan folks had left, but by the mainstream press, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, all tried to destroy Webb's reputation by going into his story, nitpicking it, trying to find little things that could have been done better, and really essentially ignoring the bigger picture, which was that the U.S. government had tolerated drug trafficking by these clients who were essentially terrorists, narco-terrorists, I guess you could call them. So that became the kind of the real world that we sort of confronted. And of course, Webb, ultimately, he was betrayed by his editors at the San Jose Mercury News, who were under career pressure themselves. And he lost his job, and he went on in a downward spiral that ultimately led to his suicide in 2004. Yet the people, many of the people that were responsible for that demonizing of Webb and essentially the helping to cover up of this major national security scandal, this Contra drug problem, those people that played ball saw their careers flourish in many cases. Some are, Michael Isikoff, who was part of this, is now a big shot at NBC. Howie Kurtz, who, of course, just now ran into trouble just yesterday on some story he did, but he was made bureau chief at Washington bureau chief for the Daily Beast and Newsweek. So you have people who were getting rewarded for getting stories wrong, and people who were getting them correct were severely punished with their livelihood stripped away. So that that was sort of a problem.
Yeah, and it portends something of what could happen with this wave of stuff going on that you're talking about, this wave of these right-wing conservative people trying to get hold of major newspapers and all this and consolidate basically a monopoly over them. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Robert Perry, investigative journalist and editor of ConsortiumNews.com. And we're talking about his article, It's the Media, Stupid. One thing, we have about 2 minutes left, Bob, and I just want to get this question out to you, which is, you pose it in your article as something that I think is a very real question. Why should people care about this? We're in the internet age, man. People watch TV, they listen to radio. Why should they care about what happens to newspapers?
Well, still the newspapers are a major force in investing in original reporting. I do work on the internet, so I sort of know a lot of this. I've been working at Consortium News for 18 years now. But but it's hard to raise the money to do the investigations. Newspapers have tended to have more of a role in that original reporting, which sets the tone for what the TV stations do, what the radio stations in those cities do. In many cases, what the internet people will do, what they'll pick up on, what they'll follow. It's just very difficult if you put all that, especially if you put more money into not getting the stories at all right, but in getting them slanted and wrong with the right-wing perspective, that makes it even more difficult. And there's been this sort of gradual, but it's all been moving in the same direction, of a right-wing dominance of the National Press Corps. And yes, there are a few exceptions here and there, but this has been a very dangerous trend that the United States has been on for the last 30 years. And when it's a trend that long, you have generations of journalists who have learned intuitively that they better not upset certain people and certain groups, because they may not have a job in the next week. They may not be able to support their families. So you have this cumulative effect, which has been very, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bob, and on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up. But I do want to let you know that we just got a phone call from your former editor at Newsweek, who said he just wanted to let you ask you to think about this. Perhaps he was telling you not to read that report so you didn't suffer from massive eye strain, okay? That was the problem, okay? Anyway, Bob, thank you very much for joining us today. All right, well, it seems like we've unfortunately lost the connection with Bob before he had a chance to say goodbye. But let me remind you, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we have been talking with Robert Perry, investigative journalist and editor of ConsortiumNews.com, about his article, It's the Media, Stupid. And that digs into the history behind recent right-wing attempts to buy up major newspapers across the country and create an even more monopolized and reactionary press. Okay, well, it might be obvious, but we've come once again to the end of yet another show, and you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank all of my guests, Larry Everest, Wayne Kramer, and Bob Perry. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, but in a discreet way, not a creepy way, you can do it on Facebook and Twitter. All right, and as we go out, once again, I want to read you an invitation offered by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Let's go on a crucial journey together, full of unity against oppression and lively struggle about the source of the problem and the solution. Pursue your own convictions that the outrages that move you are intolerable to their logical conclusion, and be determined not to stop until those outrages have been eliminated. And if this, as well as learning about other outrages and ideas about how this all fits together and flows from a common source, and how it could all be ended and something much better brought into being, leads in the direction of seeing not only the need for bold and determined resistance, but also the need for revolution and ultimately communism, then don't turn away from that, because it moves you beyond your comfort zone, challenges what had been your cherished beliefs or because of prejudices and slanders. Instead, actively seek to learn more about this revolution and its goal of communism and to determine whether it is in fact the necessary and possible solution. And then act accordingly. We're going to go out now with a very appropriate song to close this all out. It's Freedom Day by Max Roach.
Throw those shackling chains away.